Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
David taught himself how to make bread. Good bread. He wanted to get even better, so he asked ChatGPT on Expedia if there's such a thing as a bread vacation. ChatGPT said sure. Do you want to go to Normandy, Morocco, Ireland, or Tuscany? And that's how David became a master pizzaiolo. You were made to learn new things. We were made to give you trip ideas with ChatGPT right in our app. Expedia, made to travel.
World of Secrets, Season 2, investigates allegations surrounding one of the most powerful religious figures of the 21st century, T.B. Joshua. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 20th of January, these are our main stories. Japan has confirmed that it's become the fifth country to land a spacecraft on the moon successfully, although there's now a problem with its power supply. The UN has accused the Israeli military of blocking an increasing number of aid deliveries to northern Gaza. And the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin is facing a new manslaughter charge over a fatal shooting on a film set more than 2 years ago. Also coming up in this podcast.
I'm very surprised such a draconian measure has been taken. We need to check the studies that have been carried out on dolphin populations. I'm not convinced there's such a significant risk to them.
France is taking drastic action to try to protect dolphins, making their way through the Bay of Biscay off its west coast. We begin this podcast, though, with lunar exploration.
Now you see on the left-hand side, MLM, that means it has landed.
That was the moment, and it's still a rare moment, that marks a major scientific achievement, that Japan landed a spacecraft on the moon. It's only the fifth country to do it successfully. In true Japanese style, they tried to get it within 100 metres of the target landing zone on the surface. But then, a short time later, back on planet Earth, Japan's space agency realised there was a problem, having made contact with the spacecraft on the surface.
The solar cell is not generating electricity at this point in time. And since we are not able to generate electricity, and so the operation is being done using batteries on load.
So what went wrong and what now are the prospects? Well, I asked our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, firstly, if the landing could be considered a success.
That is success, but they are now in a race against time. So the spacecraft is operating solely on its batteries because for whatever reason, and we don't know yet the reason, its solar cells are not collecting sunlight and generating electricity. So it can't top up those batteries, and they will discharge over time, and they may discharge completely within a few hours. And at that point, then the slim lander will go silent. It will cease to receive commands, and it will cease to send signals to Earth. But in the meantime, yes, Japan can celebrate the fact that they have soft-landed on the moon. That's no mean feat. As we've been saying, you know, they're only the fifth nation to achieve that in the history of space exploration, so that is something. And also, it does appear that their precise navigation technology did put the spacecraft down just where they wanted it. You know, they wanted to be able to get to within this landing point near this equatorial crater to within 100 metres.
Yeah, because that's interesting. That's quite something, isn't it? That doesn't usually happen, does it?
No, I mean, they don't have GPS at the moon, right? So it's difficult. And previous missions, you know, you would talk about accuracies of several kilometres.
So what did they go for? And if they've only got a few hours, what can they actually do?
So what they do is they prioritise now the information that they most need. And because this mission was about proving those navigation technologies, they're going to download all of the data they can about the descent and how well the algorithms, the software on board worked. If they get that down, fantastic. Love a few pictures as well. That might help them understand why the solar cells are not working.
Just finally, it's not very often we get a chance to say this, but it hasn't been a great week for landing on the moon. Why are countries still going, though? And is that going to persist?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much science still to do at the moon. The Earth constantly recycles its rocks. If you want to understand the history of the Earth, the planets, and their place in the solar system, the Earth is one of the most useless places to do that because it basically overwrites the record. You go to places where that record still exists, and that's on asteroids, and it's on the moon.
Jonathan Amos there. 2,000 people using one shower, 500 people using just a single toilet. The United Nations has highlighted these figures as it repeats its warning about the severe lack of drinking water and other basic hygiene in Gaza. It says diseases like diarrhea are spreading. I heard more from Neda Torfik, our UN correspondent in New York.
The latest we're hearing from the United Nations is that the availability of water for drinking is really shrinking every single day. They are at less than a tenth of production when you look at the wells that they've been using. They are at less than 50% of capacity when you look at the fact that they are now down to just one line that is Israeli operated. They used to be able to use three Israeli lines. And beyond that, they are concerned about the spread of diseases. They are already seeing an increase in diarrhea cases, more than half of them among children under five. 500 people are sharing one toilet. Other situations, they don't have any, and there's open defecation. Again, concern about that leading to disease outbreaks. So they've really kind of tried to show just how desperate the situation is because they are trying to get more aid in and coming up against numerous hurdles.
And just quickly on that, those hurdles, what is it the UN says they are, or rather, who are they?
Well, look, they've been having rejections with little or no explanation, which has disrupted the flow of critical supplies from the Israeli military. They say that those denials have dramatically increased, especially access to North Gaza this month. So, for example, they say that 95% of missions to bring fuel and medicines to the health facilities that are barely functioning to those water reservoirs and wells to get clean water to people, 95 of those missions were denied by the Israeli military. And even trying to get water testing kits in and chlorine to treat water, they've been hit with import restrictions. Convoys have been hit, roads have been impassable. But again, it's these kind of repeated denials with no explanation that is frustrating them.
And does the UN finally say anything about what it can do to try and change that situation? It sounds like the UN is saying it can do very, very little.
I mean, yeah, we've heard kind of a clear call by the UN Secretary General and every part of the UN system saying that they need a ceasefire first and foremost. The Secretary General has said he's been troubled by clear violations of international humanitarian law. Now, aside from that, we have seen that members of the Security Council have passed a resolution that set up a coordinator to try to streamline getting aid in. Sigrid Kaag has been meeting with different parties, but we haven't yet seen that make any material impact on the ground yet.
Neda Torfik in New York City. Well, meanwhile, Israeli tanks have mounted a new assault on southern Gaza's main city, Khan Yunis, where hundreds of thousands of civilians have taken refuge from fighting in other parts of the territory. Many people have now fled from the grounds of Nasser Hospital, the biggest of the very few hospitals still functioning in Gaza. Doctors there deny Israeli claims that Hamas fighters are using it as a base. Let's go to Sierra Leone next, where the former president, Ernest Bai Koroma, has flown out of the country to Nigeria, despite having been accused of involvement in an attempted coup late last year. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, has more.
Photos show Ernest Bai Koroma being welcomed by officials at Abuja Airport. It appears he's gone into exile, at least temporarily. For weeks, the former president of Sierra Leone was under house arrest. The government had linked him to November's attacks on a barracks and a prison that it described as an attempted coup. He was charged with treason. But with tension already high in Sierra Leone after last June's disputed election, international mediators were brought in. And sources have told the BBC that an agreement was reached for Mr. Koroma to move to Nigeria in exchange for the treason charge being dropped.
A new criminal charge of involuntary manslaughter has been filed against the actor Alec Baldwin over a shooting on a movie set in 2021. The actor was preparing to film a scene in the Western Rust in New Mexico when his pistol went off, killing the cinematographer Halina Hutchins. Baldwin was initially charged with manslaughter in January 2023, but the charges were later dropped. My colleague Julia Marshall got the latest from our LA correspondent Emma Vardy.
last year, the charges were dismissed because a forensic report showed that the gun could have gone off. It had been modified in such a way that potentially could have gone off without the trigger being pulled. And Alec Baldwin has always argued that he didn't pull the trigger. He was just holding the pistol and getting ready to rehearse, getting ready to film this scene. But the forensic testing on this gun continued, and now a fresh report basically goes against the conclusions of the old one. And that means that these new charges are now facing Alec Baldwin. He continues to maintain that he did not know there was live ammunition in the gun and that he was trusting the professionals who handed it to him. And this is something that's been a debate within the film industry too. Actors' unions arguing that actors on set should be able to trust professional armourers who are trained to handle the weapons on set. So a key question in this trial is going to be, how did those live ammunition end up on set? That should have been banned. There should have been no ammunition, live ammunition on set at all. And also Alec Baldwin's actions himself. Was he negligent? Should he have done more checks himself when he was holding that pistol?
So the case now goes to trial, and I understand the movie's armourer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, is also facing the same charge.
That's right. She's also facing the charge of involuntary manslaughter. She's also indicated that she intends to plead not guilty. Interestingly, the family of Helena Hutchins had given their blessing to the film continuing to be finished. They wanted to see her work showcased, and the film did carry on filming after her death eventually and has now concluded. But they've also reacted to this fresh charge today, saying they do welcome a criminal trial because they've always looked for the truth about what happened that day.
Emma Vardy reporting from LA. France is taking drastic action to try to protect dolphins making their way through the Bay of Biscay off its west coast at this time of year. It's banning most commercial fishing for a month. The restrictions are intended to stop dolphins getting caught and then dying in fishing nets in the area. Our Europe regional editor Alice Adderley has more.
There has long been pressure in France to do something about the hundreds of dead dolphins and porpoises that are washed up on beaches on France's Atlantic coast every year, most having been caught in trawler nets in the Bay of Biscay between France and Spain. The French government has announced that from Monday, no vessels, either French or foreign, will be allowed to fish in those waters for a month. Speaking on French television, the ecology minister said it was a challenge to balance the interests of the environment with those of the economy, and that the fishing industry would be compensated for up to 85% of its losses. But French fishermen have reacted angrily and say the dolphins are not an endangered species in the area. Pascal Bouillot is the director of the La Rochelle Fishing Port Association.
I'm very surprised such a draconian measure has been taken. We need to check the analysis and look at the studies that have been carried out on dolphin populations. I'm not convinced there's such a significant risk to them. An entire industry is being jeopardised, and the fishermen have shown their willingness to put in place protective measures to deter the capture of dolphins. It's really brutal to see a measure like this being taken.
Meanwhile, environmentalists say more than 80% of dead dolphins sink or decompose at sea rather than wash ashore, suggesting the real figure of deaths is far higher and the ban should last longer.
Alice Adderley reporting. Still to come, Saudi Arabia's disruption of sport continues. Are you ready for snooker's golden balls?
I'm a purist and a traditionalist. You know, some sort of innovation is nice into the game, maybe into the rules or something like that, but I don't know about the golden ball, how it's going to work.
Remarkable personal stories.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
Deep dive documentaries.
These children are using their own bags, not to carry books, but they carry the drug markets in Sweden on their shoulders.
And sport, but not as you know it.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
The BBC World Service tells the world stories. Search for Lives Less Ordinary, The Documentary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
With Dash Pass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello again and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, listen to this, a stark warning from Germany's leader to his people.
Wenn etwas in Deutschland nie wieder Platz haben darf.
If there is something that can never, ever have a place in Germany again, it's the racist ideology of National Socialists. That is what the extremists' disgusting deportation plans amount to. They are an attack on our democracy and therefore on all of us. It's on us to act now, to take a clear stand for solidarity, for tolerance and for our democratic Germany.
Und für unser demokratisches Deutschland.
That was part of a video message from the Chancellor Olaf Scholz as protests across the country continue against the rise of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. Spontaneous demonstrations have taken place in major cities. This was an event in Hamburg.
Hamburg has the AfD!
Well, protesters there shouting, all of Hamburg hates the AfD. More large gatherings are planned in the coming days. The demonstrations started after reports that extremist politicians, including AfD members, met in secret late last year to discuss plans to expel millions of immigrants from Germany. Opinion polls also suggest that support for the party is increasing. I got more on this from our Berlin correspondent, Damian McGuinness.
Over the past week, really, almost on a daily basis, somewhere in Germany, there have been these sorts of protests. So there's been a really large one in Cologne earlier this week. Every day, almost, in some German city or town, there have been protests with thousands and thousands of people taking to streets, all with the same message, all of them saying that Germany has to stand up against the far right, and in particular, the far right AfD party. And it all comes on the back of a very controversial report, which has really rocked the country, revealing a secret meeting in which far-right activists, including some AfD, high-ranking AfD members, were planning supposedly a so-called master plan to deport millions of people with non-German background. And it's really sparked off an outcry across the country within political circles, but also with people on the street saying they're not going to take this anymore. So it actually has sort of become a large movement in many German cities, really.
And we're seeing a liberalisation of Germany's citizenship laws. It's a very important part of Olaf Scholz's policy aims, I think. Is that partly a response to what we've just been talking about, the AfD, or is this effort to widen the availability of dual citizenship in Germany a broader initiative?
What we're seeing is two things happening at the same time. On the one hand, as we've been discussing, the rise of the far right, it's undeniable. The polling numbers are unprecedented. On the other hand, Germany is becoming an increasingly diverse country. It's more open to migration than it ever has been. It's got a very left-wing government right now, left-wing-led government. And more and more younger people in particular are very open to the idea of migration, and the debate in Germany is very pro-migration. There's a general consensus that foreign workers are needed, that this is an ageing population, that for the economy, for society in general, migration is a good thing. So you have these two things happening at the same time, and this new law, which is really loosening citizenship for migrants coming to Germany, and which is going to be probably one of the most liberal in Europe, I think this is showing one direction Germany's going, and the other, at the same time, you've also got this rise in some cases, some quite anti-migrant feeling, and in some cases, clearly xenophobic feeling, and some quite radical ideas about what it means to be German, different classes of Germans, and that if you have a migration background, you're a second-class citizen compared to someone who is so-called original German. So I think those two things are happening at the same time in Germany, and that's making for a very lively political debate, to put it mildly.
Damian McGuinness reporting from Berlin. Now, Britain's Prince Harry, the King's youngest son, who now lives in the United States, has stopped legal action against a tabloid newspaper over claims that it libelled him. At the last possible moment, the Prince withdrew on Friday his libel claim against the publisher of the Mail on Sunday. It concerned an article about his security arrangements when he visits the UK and who should pay for them. The Prince will now have to pay legal costs for both sides, running into hundreds of thousands of dollars. Our media correspondent David Sillitoe has more.
In Prince Harry's ongoing legal war against Britain's newspapers, this is perhaps a minor battle. But after a series of victories against the Mail and the Mirror, it is a climb down by the Prince. The dispute is about an article in the Mail on Sunday in 2022 about his tussle with the Home Office over paying for his security arrangements. The piece, headlined "How Prince Harry Tried to Keep His Legal Fight with the Government Over Police Bodyguards a Secret," said he was responsible for attempting to mislead and confuse the public as to the true position about when he'd made the offer to pay. The Prince said there was no deception and that he'd made the offer to pay in 2020. The Mail on Sunday argued their article was an honest opinion and didn't cause him much harm. A full trial was looming. But today the case was dropped, just before a deadline for legal documents to be submitted, and media lawyer Jonathan Code feels that deadline may have had a bearing on the decision.
There's a point in every law case where both sides have to exchange documents. It's called disclosure. Some of the documents are very sensitive. It may be something which is very confidential or very private. At the point where Prince Harry has had to disclose these documents, which was 10 o'clock this morning, rather than disclosing his documents, he's written to the judge and he's withdrawn his case.
The legal bill will be sizeable, but this is just one of many cases. A much bigger claim accusing the Mail of phone hacking and other illegal practices is still going ahead. So too another against the publisher of The Sun. This is far from the end of Prince Harry versus the press.
David Solito. Now, Britain's military has used lasers to shoot down drones for the first time. As the war in Ukraine and also events in the Middle East have highlighted, the threat from drones and the ability to take them out will become important in future wars and conflicts. Here's more from our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale.
Scientists from the British Defence Ministry's research laboratory at Porton Down have been working on laser weapons for a number of years and have developed Dragonfire, the UK's first directed energy weapon. Using an intense beam of light, it can target an object the size of a coin from a kilometre away. It's been tested in the Scottish Hebrides and has successfully brought down drones flying several kilometres away. The ministry says the technology could transform modern warfare and prove far cheaper than using conventional weapons. The missiles currently being fired by Royal Navy warships to shoot down Houthi drones in the Red Sea cost at least $1 million each. The laser would be the equivalent of $12 a shot. However, developing Dragonfire is not cheap. It's already cost $120 million and might not prove as effective as missiles in destroying fast-moving targets. Unlike a missile, the laser also needs its target within visual range. The US military has been investing heavily in energy-directed weapons, but while it too has successfully tested them, they've yet to be proven in combat. That could still be years away.
Jonathan Beale, let's look at artificial intelligence now. Imagine a situation where a chatbot, a kind of automated online voice, accuses you of something that's not only untrue, but could also be professionally damaging. What would you do? What could you do? Well, this is what happened to my colleague, the BBC's technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. And it was quite a strange experience for her. She told Rebecca Kesby what happened.
It was a really strange experience. I started getting messages from people saying they'd seen something on social media about me that I should have a look at. And it turned out to be a list of the top 10 spreaders of disinformation on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. And I was at number 9. Now, it said it had been generated by a chatbot called Grok, which is run by Elon Musk's company XAI. And I was quite concerned about it because obviously that is not a list that as a journalist I want to be on. So I decided to see what I could do about it. And I found the path very, very difficult to navigate. I asked ChatGPT and Google's Bard to come up with a similar list, and both of them declined and said it would be irresponsible for them to do it. And then I decided to contact regulators here in the UK because we have been told that that is how you should complain about AI content. So I went to two different authorities and they both told me that it wasn't them and I'd have to get legal advice. So then I went to a lawyer who said I could possibly sue for defamation, but I had no sort of, it wasn't guaranteed that I would win because there's no legal precedent for this yet.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? If this was a person doing this, you would be able to sue them.
Exactly. I mean, it's very clear, you know, you and I talking on the radio, we know very well what we can and can't say about someone, and they know how to complain if they think that we've said something about them that's inaccurate. But when you're dealing with content generated by AI, it's actually much more difficult to know which path to go down. And And this is only going to become, I think, more of an issue as AI starts to generate more content and make more decisions about us.
Absolutely.
It's worth saying in this case that it turned out, I spoke to our colleagues at BBC Verify who look into misinformation, and they think that it's possible the post itself was fake. So that's a sort of another angle to the story, isn't it? But the fact was that in the moment, trying to navigate how to complain about it was very, very difficult.
Very briefly, Zoe, I mean, governments and regulators have got to get on top of this quickly, don't they? How far off are they from being able to legislate on this stuff?
There's lots of regulation and legislation incoming, but not much of it is in place yet. The EU AI Act is probably the strictest, but that's not actually likely to become law until 2025.
Zoe Kleinman on her experience with AI. Now, let's go to sport next. Saudi Arabia's big money push into the sector continues with snooker. A new event in the capital Riyadh in March will see the introduction of a new golden ball. A new ball and new rules. Well, unsurprisingly, it's controversial. Andy Swiss can explain.
In a sport of tradition, it certainly caused a stir. When snooker holds its first TV event in Saudi Arabia in March, there'll be an extra golden ball worth 20 points available to anyone who makes a maximum 147 break. Further details, such as whether the ball will be on the table throughout the match, still aren't clear. Ken Doherty is a former world champion.
You know, I'm a purist and a traditionalist. You know, some sort of innovation is nice into the game, maybe into the rules or something like that. But I don't know about the golden ball, how it's going to work.
147 has always been one of sport's most famous numbers. The maximum break was first achieved at the World Championships by Cliff Thorburn in 1983.
Oh, good luck, mate.
Yeah! Oh, wonderful!
But a 20-point golden ball would raise that maximum to 167, and recreational players at this club in Manchester remain to be convinced.
I think they're making it a bit more spectacular. Yeah. You know, they're just trying to think, right, if you're having it over here, we're going to do something special. So yeah. I think the proof will be in the pudding, won't it?
It does smell a bit of a gimmick to me, to be honest, because I think a 147 is pretty much one of the hardest things you can do in sport to begin with.
For some of the game's biggest stars, though, snooker's traditional colours of red, yellow, green, brown, blue, pink and black could soon have a golden edition.
Andy Swiss. Right, let's end the podcast on Apple. No, not that Apple, an actual Apple. When was the last time you tried a new type of Apple? There's big business in trying to get us to change our buying habits, but it can be a slow process. It can take almost a decade to produce just one new type of Apple. And then there's no guarantee it will be a success when it hits the shops. Well, Ruth Alexander, who presents the Food Chain programme on the BBC World Service, finds out more about how to invent a new type of apple.
Discovery, Cox, Howgate Wonder, Laxton Superb, Charles Ross, James Grieve, Falstaff, Katie over there, and then Brayburns. Have I done Bramley, Howgate Wonder?
I love these names.
And Lane's Prince Albert over there, the old one that my father's orchard contained, yeah.
Alan Hewitt and his son Chris grow all sorts of apples for their Dunham Press cider and juice near Manchester, England, and are adapting what they do due to changing weather conditions. More on that shortly. But I hadn't realised so many apple varieties were created by people. So what's it like to see a brand new apple you've had a hand in inventing hit the shops?
That's an amazing feeling when it, not only you see it on the shelf, but you see people buy it. That's really exciting.
Professor Kate Evans is a fruit breeder at Washington State University in the United States. She was involved in the development of the Cosmic Crisp apple. It went on sale in 2019 and already has a sizable market share.
There are many, many reasons why an apple makes it or not. That one, it fitted what growers were looking for in terms of when it harvests, and it stores very well.
Who comes up with the name?
The Cosmic Crisp name came up from a fabulous colleague of mine, Carolyn Ross, from the School of Food Science, who ran some consumer focus groups for us. And one consumer came up with the word cosmic because the white lenticels on the skin of the fruit reminded them of stars in the cosmos. And the crisp was just an obvious once you bit the apple.
Yeah, so it came down to a genius consumer.
There you go. Yes.
Creating and then selling your delicious new apple is an expensive business. For this reason, many of the big apple brands are what's known as club varieties.
You need to put the investment in to get it planted, and you need to put the investment in to get it known.
This is Ali Kappa, who chairs British Apples and Pears, an organisation for commercial growers.
So a way of doing that is to create a club or an exclusivity around a variety. And what that means for a grower is that you can generally only buy it from one or a selection of nurseries. So you can't buy it everywhere. It means there's a premium on the tree, and that premium is used to help fund the marketing. And often that's a global job.
One new variety that's recently been launched, Tutti, is being marketed as the world's first variety bred specifically for a hot climate. Developed by a partnership of scientists and growers in New Zealand and Spain, it's hoped it'll be grown in places like Catalonia, where hotter summers have been a challenge for apple producers. With more unpredictable weather, growers want to know they can still produce a steady supply of apples, which is where the club varieties can have an advantage.
The benefit to the consumer of the club varieties is consistency. It's really important to us as growers that when shoppers go into store and buy apples, they get a consistently high quality, brilliant product. Because if they don't, they'll go and buy an orange or an apricot or grapes instead next time they go in.
That report by Ruth Alexander. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. As always, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly-Forster. The producer was Liam McSheffrey, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.